The Daily Connect podcast, the voice of the RNIB Connect community.
Hello, I'm Stephen Scott and welcome to the first of our Daily Connect podcasts, your chance to catch up with what's been going on the show throughout the day. This podcast is for Monday, the 30th of July, 2018. And on today's programme, we looked at one of the ways that you could raise money for RNIB and have lots of fun at the same time. Imagine yourself jumping out of a perfectly serviceable aircraft. Well, that's what RNIB's Big Jump is all about. Today we met Imran Akhtar, who did it last year and absolutely loved it. Now, this is the show to get you talking, and today we asked if you think being disabled today is any better than it was 8 years ago. I'm thinking here in terms of technology, employment prospects, or people's attitudes. This all follows an interview aired on RNIB Connect Radio over the weekend in our Reflections programme from the Torch Trust, where Shadow Minister for Disabled People, Marcia de Cordova, suggests that in the last 8 years, not much improvement has been made for disabled people. Now, we'll give you a chance to hear that interview again in just a few moments. You can also give your thoughts on the Daily Connect poll that is now up on Twitter. You'll find it at RNIB Radio and use the hashtag The Daily Connect. We also check in with another of our RNIB Connect team to find out what's going on around the UK, and we get a chance to find out how eye conditions really affect people through our How I See campaign, where visually impaired people talk about their eye condition from their own point of view, not in some kind of medical way. Nikki Kelly, who you might remember from our first forum conversation we did on Friday, will be talking to us about optic atrophy and keratoconus. Oh, and Roland Myers from Infosound drops in to tell us about some of the support groups that are now for those living with macular degeneration, a handy resource for all, I'm sure. And as it started off a bit of a miserable Monday, I thought we might need a dog in the office to cheer us all up. And that's exactly what we have with our new Pause for Thought story, which we'll bring you from Lynette Proctor.
The Daily Connect podcast.
So let's kick things off then with the big story that we covered on the show, and that is around the subject of disability and quality of life. Now, what do you think about that? Do you think that compared to, say, the last 8 to 10 years, that you think that your quality of life has improved or gotten worse? Well, Shadow Minister for Disabled People, Marcia de Cordova, spoke to our Reflections programme on Sunday and suggested that life has not improved in the way it perhaps should have. Have a listen to that section of the interview now and share your thoughts by answering our online poll on Twitter. You'll find it at RNIB Radio, or drop me an email, radio@rnib.org.uk, to tell us what you think about what the Minister has been saying. She was speaking to the Torch Trust presenter Sheila Armstrong, who firstly asked Marcia de Cordova if she believed having a sight loss condition herself made her the best candidate for the job.
I feel that because I'm a disabled person and I'm living with sight loss, absolutely I have the lived experience, which will obviously bring a new dimension or new element to the role as the Shadow Minister for Disabled People. Obviously my career has been spent working in the voluntary sector for disability organisations, so I also bring a wealth of knowledge and experience to the role.
That's excellent. Yes, well, I agree. As a blind person myself, I'm delighted that you've been appointed to this role as Shadow Minister for Disabled People, because obviously, you know, people like us who are disabled feel that somebody's really speaking up for them in a personal way, really.
No, absolutely. I mean, you do feel a great deal of pressure as well, because I am a disabled person and obviously being that voice for millions of other disabled people as well. But, you know, it's such a privilege and an honour to serve in that capacity. So I'm really pleased to be doing the job.
Do you think it's even harder for somebody with a disability to get people to believe that you can actually really do the job?
Well, I think, you know, if somebody has a problem with a disabled person's ability, or somebody who lives with sight loss's ability to do a job that I do, then it's their own kind of biases and prejudices that they need to deal with, and it's their problem. And, you know, nobody is given a job because of their disability or they're a disabled person. It's because they are capable and have the required skills, knowledge and experience to do something. So I would certainly go back to saying it's an individual's own prejudices that they need to address.
Absolutely. Well, you obviously can do the job, it's quite clear. So what kind of adjustments has Parliament made to make it better for you to do the job?
So being registered blind, I obviously have to have all my papers produced in an alternative format. So that happens. So all policy papers, my order paper for the day, things like that have to be produced in an alternative format for me. I'm a Zoom Text user, so my PC has Zoom Text installed on it. I have a large print keyboard. I have a sighted assistant who assists me in Parliament, as well as when I'm out and about in my constituency, and she acts as my eyes to get me to where I need to go. And I also use taxis as well to help me get around also. So the services here have obviously made the necessary reasonable adjustments to enable me to fulfil my role.
Now, this is maybe a bit of a tricky question, but do you think it's easier for disabled people now than it was, say, 30 years ago?
In what respect?
Well, just generally living and, having a good quality of life and being included in society.
Well, I think there's no question, if we think back to where we were 50 years ago, we've obviously moved forward and we've moved on. But I think it's fair to say that disabled people still don't have equal parity, and although legislation was introduced to ensure that in areas such as education, employment and transport and access to goods and services that disabled people were given equal parity, but I think over the last 8 years I think we've seen policies that have disproportionately hit disabled people harder. So whilst we should have made progress, we haven't. If we just take employment, for example, particularly people living with sight loss, we know that, I think, is it one in four people living with sight loss of working age are currently in work. So I think we still have a long way to go, because that number has increased rather than reduced.
Yeah, why do you think that is, Marcia?
Well, I think there's several factors to that, but I still believe that more work needs to be done around shaping employer attitudes in terms of ensuring that they recognise and acknowledge that disabled people can do a job or can be in work. And I think there's that aspect. And obviously the opportunities that are allotted to people through education, we still face a number of barriers there. And we also, there are schemes like Access to Work, which in my opinion play a vital role and is one of the best forms of employment support, are not well publicised. So not everybody is or are aware that these schemes, that particular scheme exists. So for me, it's going to be a job of ensuring that we can reduce the employment barriers that face disabled people, to ensure that we see more people who are disabled in work.
Marcia de Cordova speaking to Sheila Armstrong there. Marcia is the Shadow Minister for Disabled People, talking about the rather interesting subject of us as disabled people, blind and partially sighted people in particular, not really having a massive improvement in their lives, especially around employment prospects. That's one example that Marcia gave. Do you agree or disagree? Well, you can add your voice to the conversation and we'll talk about it on future programmes. You can email radio@rnib.org.uk, or of course you can find me on Twitter @RNIBRadio. If you're looking for me personally, you'll find me @TechTalkerSteve.
The Daily Connect Podcast.
Now, regularly on the show, we're going to be hearing from people who talk about how they see, it could actually mean anything, quite frankly, but the way we're talking about it this week is looking at the eye condition that someone has and asking them to explain it to us in words that any of us can understand. It doesn't matter whether you're blind or partially sighted, or you're fully sighted or not. Understanding someone else's eye condition is quite difficult. A lot of people who are partially sighted can't quite understand what I can see. I don't really understand what it's like to be totally blind. All of that stuff. Well, Nikki Kelly decided to get in touch with us to share her thoughts on her eye conditions, because she's got more than one. She's got optic atrophy and keratoconus. At least I think that's how you pronounce it. I'll let Kelly do the introduction.
Hi, I'm Nikki Kelly. I'm a community facilitator for RNIB in the West Midlands. My sight condition is optic atrophy and keratoconus. I was initially diagnosed in October 2007. Optic atrophy basically means that the cells are dying from the inside out. Keratoconus means that my eye is shaped more like a cone. It's somehow managed to go from a ball into a cone, and it's quite severe in my right eye. How I see is in my left eye, I've got very little vision. Everything's blurry unless I hold it up really, really close to to my face. In my right eye, I've got patches of good vision and no field of vision in both eyes. So that's how I see, very little. There are some treatments. There's a new one called corneal cross-linking, which should slow down the process of the eye changing shape. There's also corneal transplants, which I've heard quite a lot about. Some people have had a lot of success with them, some people haven't. And as I've got problems with the back of my eyes, and that cannot be repaired, it's very difficult for the corneal transplant to actually make much of a difference. Therefore, I haven't had one. My sight allows me to do everything but drive, so I still find a way to do everything I possibly can do. It's just that I have to do it in a different way now. I'm Nikki Kelly. Thank you so much for listening, and you're listening to RNIB Connect Radio.
Hurrah! Yes, you are. Thank you, Nikki. Great story. If you want to share your thoughts on how you see, maybe because you might think it will help others, including perhaps immediate family and friends, you know, then you can use us to help share the story. You can email radio@rnib.org.uk. On the show days, of course, when we're on air at 10 till 12, weekdays live, you can call me on 0345 602 0025. That is my number. Feel free to give me a call, but you have to do that between 10 and 12 during the day, weekdays, in the morning. And you're more than welcome to get in touch with the programme. Otherwise, Twitter, Facebook, email, get in touch and share your thoughts.
The Daily Connect Podcast.
It's now time to meet Roland Myers, who works for a charity called Infosound. And Infosound has a website called infosound.org.uk where they have lots of audio stories on a whole wide range of topics. You've probably heard one or two of them, and if you haven't heard of Roland before, you'll certainly know his voice. This is Roland now telling us on the Daily Connect this week all about macular support groups, and one in particular that's just started.
A new support group for people with macular degeneration has been launched in Shetland, and it's one of over 400 local macular support groups across the UK. This latest group, set up by the Macular Society in partnership with NHS Shetland and Shetland Islands Council, aims to meet on the first Wednesday of every month. And the Macular Society places great emphasis on the benefits of these locally based groups because of the peer support they provide. Those who have a macular-related eye condition directly supporting others who have the same condition. And those with other eye conditions are sometimes welcome to attend group meetings where people can meet, discuss, learn, socialise and, well, as we discovered when we spoke to the charity's head of service delivery, Tessa Barrett, these groups do whatever best suits their members' needs.
We have 407 support groups, and all of those run in a very different way. So it is what the group wants the group to be. So it's very much led by the people who are turning out. So if they come along and they want to hear from maybe an eye clinic liaison officer, then we can get an eye clinic liaison officer there to talk to them. If they want to know about the benefits and their welfare, we can get somebody to talk to them about benefits and welfare. It may be that they want to have a social event. So we quite often find that cream teas, and some of the groups run tea for MD, so tea for macular degeneration. And so there are a whole host of things, but they're very much tailored to what the people in that specific local area want.
You were talking about benefits, for example, discussing those. That could be of particular interest to someone who's of a particular age. Someone else might want to know about something else. So do they kind of, I was going to say make it up as they go along. I mean that in the most sort of beneficial way, that basically you, if you like, go on a journey yourselves as the members sort of form and run the group.
Yes, that is exactly what happens. So because we have our Macular Society helpline here in Great Britain on the mainland, what we tend to find is our mainline telephone number is the biggest source of contact for anybody across the United Kingdom. And that will also be extended to people from Shetland as well. So if, for instance, the group is wanting specifically to know something for the group, then we would ensure that there was a way in which the whole group got to hear that information. It isn't just age-related macular degeneration that we support. You know, macular degeneration can affect any age group, and there are so many different conditions. So there is going to be different information that people want for which sight condition they have, and we can't expect our groups to have all of that knowledge in-house, but we certainly have got it here, and we can support them with what they need to know.
And people are going to hear about the new group springing up on Shetland, and they may think, do you know what we could do with a group here? Is the process of forming a new group simple? I presume you are the guiding force behind that. Can they get in touch with you? And indeed, can they get in touch with you to find out that maybe there is one closer than they think?
Yes, we set up macular support groups in areas where there is need. And quite often what we find is when we set up a group, then somebody maybe 9 or 10 miles away might think that they need a group where they are. Older people who predominantly attend at these support groups are restricted by public transport. So when you've lost your sight and you have lost the ability to be able to drive your car, you are reliant on being able to get there. So either somebody to pick you up, a taxi service, or a bus route. So it is not always that everybody can get to just one group. So we quite understand that sometimes we have to set up additional groups, and they're very straightforward to set up, providing there is the interest in attending. So I'm going to give you a good for instance here. In North Wales, some of our groups run with only 5 people attending them, but that's because the area in which that group has been set up in is a small, very rural area where there's a lack of rail or bus networking, and that's a good group for them. So we don't say that a group has to be 30 people deep. It is dependent on the area that the group is set up in.
So it really is literally tailored to the local need, and as you're actually indicating here, the individual need.
Yes, absolutely. Our regional managers set up the groups and support people to run those groups. So we try not to interfere in the day-to-day running of the group. So therefore, the group is exactly what the local people want it to be. But we will support them to be able to put that group on. And the reason that we are very passionate about our peer support groups is that we know that peer support is the finest way of supporting people. So people supporting people. And those people who have been newly diagnosed with macular degeneration can support other people who are perhaps much further down, and vice versa. So dependent on where you are in your sight loss journey, there is always somebody at the group who can support you with some of the hurdles that you might be looking at, you know, some of the anxieties and fears you may have around your condition. It's a good way to find the answers to questions that you've got, and you can bet your life if you've got a question, somebody else along the way will have also had that question and will know the answer. So we know that when people arrive at a group, wherever they are on their sight loss journey, there is always somebody else who has been there before them and will have experienced it, maybe will know the answer to the question that they've got. So peer support is the finest kind of support that you can get.
And you can contact the Macular Society via their national helpline by phoning 0300 30 30 111. That's 0300 30 30 111. Or they can be emailed at help@macularsociety, all one lowercase word, macularsociety.org. And if you make contact, they can tell you about the kind of support that they offer nationally. For example, technical information, daily living support, and eye condition information. But as we heard, you can also find out where the nearest local macular support group is to where you live, or even inquire about starting one if there's a need in your area.
Thank you so much for that, Roland. Really appreciate getting that information. Hey, in Shetland, I tell you, we really do get all around the UK. Great to hear about that, the macular degeneration support groups, which is such an important thing if you live with that condition. Having other people to talk to is really, really important. Roland, thanks for sharing.
The Daily Connect podcast.
It's the voice of the RNIB Connect community, and one of the ways that we're sharing your voice on the programme is through 150 stories. It all relates to the 150th anniversary of RNIB. Ian Wilson's here with another of your brilliant stories.
This year marks RNIB's 150th anniversary. To celebrate, we've been asking the blind and partially sighted community for their stories and experiences of sight loss. We will be sharing these stories over the coming months to document the changes we've seen in the last 150 years. Today is the story of Nikki Coburn. She says, "I first heard about In Your Pocket from a gentleman called Alan from South Wales Talking Magazines. It sounded amazing and I knew I'd love it. In Your Pocket is a portable device that allows you to listen to audiobooks podcasts, the latest editions of newspapers and magazines, and now you can even make phone calls on it. I've always been an avid reader and have fond memories of my parents reading to me as a child. I'm not a fan of reading Braille, and I find the books rather cumbersome, so this was perfect. It's a simple concept, anyone can use it, and it makes me feel like I'm in the real world with everyone else. If you're interested in sharing your story, please complete the submission at www.rnib.org.uk/150stories.
Thanks for that, Ian.
The Daily Connect Podcast.
Now, Lynette Proctor never got on with her cane and relied on her mum to guide her until she got Pippa. Now she's doing stuff she never even dreamed she could do, and life apparently is all the more exciting for it.
My name is Lynette Proctor. I have a guide dog and her name is Pippa. We qualified in March 2013. We've done so many things since I got Pippa. When I first applied for a guide dog, I wasn't going out independently at all. I was having to go to hospital appointments, college counselling sessions, all supported by my mum, which for being in your early 20s, you don't really want to have to take your mum everywhere with you. My mum says that she was a brilliant guide, but when we used to walk into supermarkets, she'd get distracted by a really good deal, and then I'd be left standing in the middle of the shop, not knowing where she'd gone and what she was looking at. So having a dog, to me, felt that maybe I was going to be able to sort of look at the things that I wanted to do and maybe not prioritise the boring things like shopping and counselling and hospitals and be able to do things that were a bit more spontaneous. Not long sort of after getting her, I'd said so many times that I kept saying no to things that I wanted to start saying yes. So we agreed to travel up to the Lake District and do a lot of work with kids and young people who have got sight loss. We started traveling down to London for work and to sort of visit my friend in Birmingham a lot. So the more Pippa kind of got used to getting out and about, the more sort of relaxed she became at all these long train journeys and working in places that maybe she wasn't familiar with. I do think that Pippa comes well before my needs, remembering that when we're going out in the morning to make sure she's got everything that we need for the day. Quite often my handbag or my suitcase, if we're on long journeys, is half full of like her dog bed, her toys, her food, her water bowl, enough water for the journey. I've had to plan all the sort of stops off and everything. It's almost like having a child with you quite a lot. And we have travelled around sort of on very sort of like long train journeys where I have on occasion, sort of not long after getting her, we've stuck on a train that had been cancelled a few times and I've gone, oh no, what if she needs to go and spend? Which obviously she didn't. She's really well trained, but I didn't know how long she could hold it in for. It's at the point where she sort of signaled to me that she might need to go. So we've learned that long train journeys, it means that we have to make sure we've factored that sort of time into our transport, like links and everything. One of the big things about having a dog is people are constantly amazed about the work that they do, and you do have people coming up to you all the time, but sometimes it can be negative. Sometimes you can have somebody jump down in front of you and kneel on the floor at a train station and try and talk to the dog while you're walking along the platform, and people don't understand that, well, this dog's doing a job, it's trying to avoid me going onto the track and you're suddenly squatting down and speaking to her and distracting her from my work. But then other times you might be actually needing support. If I have been sat somewhere and somebody's come over to offer me assistance but asked the stranger next to me instead, who had no idea because they weren't even with me, they were just sat on the same group of chairs. The thing is, if I hadn't had Pippa, people didn't know because I wasn't a cane user. I used to find the cane very restricting. I used to describe it as sort of like pushing a shopping trolley where the shakes sort of go up your arm. And I found everything about using the cane quite sort of negative, whereas I'd always loved animals. So to choose to have a guide dog for me felt like a perfect thing because I didn't see her as a negative. I saw her as something that I could interact with and something that could actually sort of force me to get out and about and do more things. And some of the things that we've done really are amazing. We climbed a mountain together, which if you'd have asked me before I had her, would I have had the confidence not only to leave the front door and get out and about independently, to be able to go back to work, to be able to finish studies, to be able to just do everything that I should be able to do, but could I actually go on then and climb a mountain? Or I even learned to scuba dive and got my scuba license. There's so many different things that, yes, she's helped me get out and about, but she's also allowed me to do even more than I'd ever expected. And I don't know what I'm going to end up doing next year, because I didn't know this year that what I was going to end up doing. So it's quite exciting, but it allows me to get excited about everything as well, and allows me to sort of be who I want to be and not be sort of anything dictated to me just because of my vision.
That's Lynette Proctor sharing her Pause for Thought story on the Daily Connect this week. If you want to tell us your story about you and your furry guide dog, and even your non-furry guide dog, then you can get in touch, radio@rnib.org.uk.
The Daily Connect podcast.
Now, if you went along to see the latest Mission Impossible film this weekend, first of all, tell me what you think of it, because I quite fancy it, I must admit. As long as the audio description's good on it. If it's not, then I won't bother. But if it did give you the bug to try your own stunts, just like Tom Cruise, then this next item might be up your street. I am building this up incredibly. While not quite as dangerous, in fairness, RNIB's Big Jump could be the thrill ride that you are looking for. You could be your own Tom Cruise. It's a great way to have fun and raise money for RNIB at the same time. Now, Imran Akhtar, who is registered blind himself, took part in last year's event and raised over £2,500. Earlier on the Daily Connect, he told us, and in particular Alan Russell, why he did it.
It's something that's always been in the back of my mind. I've always loved speed when I love roller coasters and that kind of thing. But on the other hand, I am actually scared of heights. It's weird because on a roller coaster, you're strapped in, you know, nothing can go wrong. But even now, when I'm standing at the edge of a train station platform and I look down, I'm a little bit uneasy. I feel myself gravitating towards it. It was a strange thing to do. And my wife was like, nope, you're not doing it. You're definitely not doing it. But I managed to talk her around, because it is once in a lifetime thing. You hear about people doing it and how amazing it is. And I thought that if I can just get over the mental block of doing it, I knew it would be great.
So tell me about the training and the day. How does it all work?
You're called up quite early, about 8 o'clock in the morning, and there's lots of people there to do the skydive. It's probably about 8 or 9 people in all. And it's a waiting game. It's a very, very long waiting game, because obviously it depends on the weather. If there's a lot of cloud cover or it's raining, then you can't go up. Obviously, safety is the number one concern. So I was there, and I hope I'm not putting a dampener on it, but on the first day, I didn't actually get to do the skydive. There were clouds all day, and I was waiting and waiting, and it just didn't happen for me. So I actually went home with my tail between my legs. But then a month later, I went back again, and went through all the training. They show you the plane and how to jump, and more importantly, how to land, because that's how most injuries happen. So they actually recorded you saying that we've been taught how to land. So after the training, then again, it was just a matter of waiting. And I was getting a little bit nervous because the clouds were gathering, and it was getting late in the day, and only 2 other people had done the jump. So I'd resigned myself to it not happening. But then over the tannoy, as they said, could Imran Akhtar please come to the office? And I'm not joking, my heart jumped into my mouth. It was, I was like, oh no, this is the thing I've been waiting for. Now it's actually staring me in the face. I thought, oh no, this is not good. But so I got strapped in, and we went up in this tiny, tiny little plane. It was me and one other girl was jumping. It took about 4 or 5 minutes to get to the altitude. And the strangest thing was, I mean, after going up, I was actually fine. But when it really did hit me about what's happening here is the girl actually jumped before me. So she was just sitting at the edge of the plane, and then she was just gone. It's like she jumped into oblivion. I thought, where'd she go? I didn't know where she went. And then I thought, no, this isn't right. There's something that's not natural. But then the guy scooshed me over to the opening, so I was just hanging on for dear life. I took my position that he told me to take, and then he did actually push me out because I don't think I could have done it otherwise. So then we went out, and then. Oh my god. Well, the only really scary bit is the half second when you're just about to jump out, but then after that, I am not joking, it's the best experience ever. The free fall was about 20 seconds and I just wished it was about 20 minutes. It was that exhilarating. It's hard to explain it. It doesn't really feel like you're falling. It feels like you're in suspended animation and you don't feel the speed. It's really hard to explain, but it feels like you're floating down. You can hear the wind rushing around your head, but it doesn't feel like you're actually falling. So when the parachute went up, then we got down in about 4 or 5 minutes, and yeah, it was, when I got to the ground, I just wanted to go straight back up and do it again. It was that great.
Imran Akhtar there talking to Alan Russell about his experience of the big jump that he did for RNIB last year. You can take part in this year's. It's on the 23rd of September this year. And, go along and raise some money. Imran there raised over £2,500, which is incredible. You could do the same. All you've got to do is sign up. Go to the website rnib.org.uk for more details. That's it for the podcast for today. We'll do another one tomorrow. Around about the same time, you'll find it on the podcast at 5:30. Download it by going to the RNIB Connect podcast, which you'll find on iTunes or on Audioboom or indeed anywhere that you download podcasts. If you've managed to find it, which clearly you have because you're listening, then great, but subscribe and get more. Don't forget the show is live as well, Monday to Friday, 10 till 12, but this podcast is a summary of all of that in case you missed the show, because we all have busy lives. So if you miss the show, don't worry, the podcast will always be here from 5:30, and you can keep up to date with what's happening on the Daily Connect right here with me. I'll leave you with that, and just a quick note to say, if you want to get in touch with the show, a couple of ways to do it: radio@rnib.org.uk, that's the email address. Please do get in touch and share your thoughts. We're on Twitter. You'll find us at RNIB Radio. Facebook, RNIB Connect Radio is where you'll find us. Or when we're live on air, on the show, you can call me in the studio on this number, 0345 602 0025. Calls are charged at a local rate. Mobile costs may vary. If you call from a landline, it should be included in your bundle, so it's fine to make the call at 0345 602 0025. The show's back tomorrow at 10 a.m. Join me for that if you can. Lots of interesting stuff coming up. And don't forget, you can also check out the podcast for a full summary of events from about 5:30 on the feed. Thanks so much, and I'll catch you tomorrow.
The Daily Connect Podcast.